Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups. Epson.com.
We got Janet Yellen, we got GDP, we got inflation. Yeah, it's been quite a week, all right. Our weekly wrap coming up. We'll also talk House of Cards, the music industry, and how to make it in the global economy as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Battelle, for 85 years solving what matters most for consumers, businesses, and the government. Learn more at Battelle.org. And by Robert W. Baird & Company, employee-owned and independent, Baird has kept clients' financial interests first since 1919. BairdWealth.com has more information. And by Malwarebytes, engineered to deliver a smart defense against zero-day malware, exploits, and ransomware for business, for home. Malwarebytes.org/marketplace.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, everybody, the 27th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us. It being a Friday, as you might have heard, and this having been a week of a decent amount of economic news, we are going to start by wrapping it all up in 4.5 minutes of live radio. Here to do that with us are Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, also Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. They are in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kat.
Hi, Kat.
All right, so lots of stuff to get through. We will move briskly. Lynette, we'll start with gross domestic product. It came out this morning a hair less good than we had expected. And then last quarter, what do you think? What's your gut? Do you care?
It was wah-wah. No one wants to see the GDP go down. What we do have to be proud of, and we can hold this high as a nation, is that the last number, which was a booming 5%, was not revised down. So that we can take home to mama.
And we will. Cardiff, quick thoughts on that before we move briskly onward?
We were expecting it not to be so great. I actually think the underlying impulse, the underlying trends in the economy are still pretty good. And so long as those jobs numbers keep coming in strong, I'm feeling confident that the economy will be fine.
All right, well, let me ask you about the jobs numbers. I want to talk by way of inflation about the jobs numbers. We posited yesterday, given the inflation numbers that came out, the CPI, we said, you know what? Maybe the number to pay attention to in this economy is not jobs that we obsess over every month, as we all do, but maybe inflation. What do you think, Cardiff? Does inflation deserve to have a little bit of primacy now that the jobs are basically back?
They both matter, and part of the reason is that they're related to each other, right? So long as the economy is strong and it's creating jobs, there should be signs of inflationary pressures. And so long as inflation is flat, so long as we're not seeing the kind of growth back towards the Federal Reserve's 2% target and inflation is below that, then I think we can take that as a sign that the economy has more room to grow and that policymakers should push on it.
Lynette, thoughts on inflation?
Well, another reason to look at inflation right now is because the rest of the world seems to be in a deflation funk. And so what we should be watching is whether or not the United States is getting sucked into that deflationary whirlpool. Now, I will continue beating this drum. I have beat it since probably the first day that I came on this program. Wage growth.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's true. That's totally true. And you have been remarkably consistent in that. And we'll keep going.
Thank you.
Anytime. Topic number three. Janet Yellen goes to Capitol Hill, delivers some testimony, says we're going to keep on being patient, also fends off audit the Fed. Drum beating, shall we say. Thoughts on that, you guys? Cardiff, you get to go first.
Yeah, I mean, she clearly wanted to make the case that the Fed is not going to be vulnerable to political influence. And she wanted to also make the case that it hasn't to this point been vulnerable to political influence. And in terms of monetary policy, I saw a Janet Yellen that wanted to preserve flexibility. So you mentioned patience on that. Mm-hmm. She had mentioned before that so long as that word is included in the FOMC statements, that they wouldn't raise rates for a couple of meetings. She wanted to push the case that the Fed would make its policy decisions based on how the economy performs, not based on some previous specific words that they communicated to the public.
Right. And Lynette, she's been really clear about that. I mean, every other word out of her mouth when she does those press conferences after the meetings is data, data, data.
I think that Janet Yellen has been incredibly clear. And I think that, unfortunately, someone told a congressman about Nehru, which is like, you know, all these like complex economic terms that they then try to use and like throw in her face. And poor woman is just there trying to repeating the same things over and over again about how the Fed measures the economy. And these guys, just don't give them a vocabulary book.
All right. Now, perhaps the most important question of the past 18 hours in our lives.
Uh-oh.
What color is the dress, Cardiff?
Look, I saw black and blue.
Black and blue, yes. Black and blue,
that's
yes.
That's what I saw.
Yes.
You know?
Lynette?
I can't stop seeing white and gold.
Oh, no. How do you? I don't even understand.
I don't understand you.
Oh,
you're an alien.
Lynette Lopez
you
from
guys
Business
are freaks.
Insider. Cardiff Garcia from FT Alphaville. We got to go. Have a good weekend. All right, everybody.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. The Congress of the United States, as you know, has been betwixt and between on how and whether to fund the Department of Homeland Security. Our managing editor, Mark Miller, has the latest.
I'm Mark Miller for Marketplace.
Jeez. Traders looked around today, didn't much care for what they saw. All three major indices finished in the red. Best month on Wall Street, though, since 2011, since you're checking. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Season 3 of House of Cards is upon us, and whether you love it or hate it, and there are strong feelings on both sides, fact is that when Netflix released all 13 hours or whatever it was at 3 o'clock this morning, East Coast time, it was sucking up a big chunk of the broadband capacity in this country, which gets us, in a somewhat roundabout way, to the Federal Communications Commission and its much-awaited vote on net neutrality yesterday. It said, as you remember, among a whole bunch of other things, that broadband providers like Comcast and Verizon have to treat all internet users the same. Can't speed them up, can't slow them down, whether you like Netflix or don't. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more.
Frank Underwood, political schemer extraordinaire, is finally president. Here's a little taste from the first few minutes of the new season of House of Cards. Don't worry, no spoilers.
Oh, I wouldn't be here if I had a choice, but I have to do these sort of things now. Makes me seem more human. And you have to be a little human when you're the president.
To be human these days, for many of us, is to binge watch. But maybe you've had this experience before. You're streaming a video on Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, whatever, when suddenly it starts shuttering or buffering.
And you, the consumer, won't know who to blame.
Susan Crawford is the co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.
What the FCC is doing is saying, for the very first time, we're going to be looking hard at what Comcast and other ISPs are doing to squeeze the connections between their own network and outside networks. There is a cop on the beat now.
In other words, the FCC wants to regulate the internet just as it does other utilities, like phone lines, to make sure all users are treated the same. But Richard Bennett, a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, says the difference between phones and internet is demand.
Because people always demand more usage, more capacity from the internet. And if the internet service providers are not able to keep up with the rate of increased demand on the part of consumers, then the overall experience slows down for everybody.
Bennett thinks if the FCC's reporting requirements are too burdensome, it could slow the rate at which internet service providers are able to grow their networks. And thanks in part to shows like House of Cards, daily internet usage is doubling every couple of years. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you want to know, by the way, what it's like to be at Netflix global headquarters when a phenomenon like House of Cards goes live, we did exactly that story last season. We spent the night up there. It's actually a cool story. It's on our homepage, marketplace.org. If you decided to skip the llamas yesterday and watch C-SPAN instead, you might have heard this being said on the Senate floor.
2014 has been the warmest year on record. I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball.
That's Republican Senator Jim Inhofe, the chairman of the Senate Committee on the Environment, and whose book is called The Greatest Hoax, How the Global Warming Conspiracy Threatens Your Future. The snowball stunt yesterday was, viewers were led to believe, evidence that Washington's recent snow is evidence of that hoax. It's ideological, that argument is, but there is also an economic lens here involving the cost of not actually acting on climate change, yes, but also the benefits of being to whom exactly. From the Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
There is a market for gridlock. In a physical sense, traffic jams are good for street advertisers and this radio show. So it is with climate change. Throw a wrench in the science conversation, or in this case, a snowball, and the incumbent sector wins.
Climate change as a market issue represents a market shift.
Andy Hoffman at the University of Michigan Business School is author of How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate.
Some will win, some will lose. Keeping things confused, that's how you create paralysis.
And keep the revenues flowing. Paralysis is an active effort, says Harvard science historian Naomi Oreskes.
A whole network of people have worked for more than 20 years now to prevent action because action threatens their interests and it also threatens their ideology.
Oreskes' upcoming documentary, Merchants of Doubt, features conservative activist Mark Morano. The think tank he works for is funded by fossil interests. Here's a clip from the film.
Gridlock is the greatest friend a global warming skeptic has because that's all you really want. There's no legislation we're championing. We're the negative force. We're just trying to stop stuff.
Morano, it turns out, was one spokesman for Senator Inhofe. For all the winners of paralysis, there are economic losers, says John Hofmeister, former president of Shell Oil. He worked on the doomed climate cap and trade bill back when he was company president.
The economic cost of not preparing sooner rather than later will put us in worse position rather than more favorable position as the years roll on.
That is, inaction raises average global temperatures, thus raising the cost of dealing with it. A study suggests 1 degree hotter costs an extra $150 billion to the U.S. economy. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Probably the entirety of my childhood memories are somewhat connected to water, connected to the beach.
Water as identity. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 81 points today, 0.4%, closed at 18,132. The NASDAQ off 24 points, 0.4%, finished at 4,963. The S&P 500 down 6 points, 0.3%, ended things at 2,104. Some tallies on this last day of the week, last business day of the short month. The Dow down a hair on the week, up 5.6% on the month. The NASDAQ down 0.2% on the week, up 7.1% on the month. The S&P 500 down 0.3% the last 5 days, up 5.5% this month. All right, you ready for some deja vu? Shares in JCPenney tumbled more than 6% today. Seriously, how many times have I said that? Anybody counting? After the retailer surprised analysts with a quarterly loss, holiday sales at Penney were up, but all that was eaten up by higher operating expenses. The Monster Beverage Corporation said a deal is struck with Coke last year is going gangbusters. Shares in the drink company buzzed up 13% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. Workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups. Epson.com. And by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times. Prepare to read beyond the expected. And by Condor Airlines, introducing new service from Portland, Oregon, and Providence, Rhode Island. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Want to tell your story? Be part of our listener-generated series, I've Always Wondered, featuring questions from you about the economy. Submit your story and check out the ones we've already done at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for January. The Hills came alive with The Sound of Music 50 years ago on March 2nd, 1965, when the film premiered in New York City. And it's National Procrastination Week, but let's think about that later. We're making a list of our favorite things. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'm going to tell you about a big change to something right now that you probably didn't even know was a thing. The timing of when record companies release new albums. They typically drop on different days of the week, depending on where you are. Here, it's Tuesday. In Germany, it's Friday. England, it's Monday. That's pretty much a formula for illegal file-sharing arbitrage, if you think about it for a second. So the music industry has decided to set a standard global release day, Friday. But, and you may well have gotten here ahead of us, the entire notion of a release date is a little quaint in this digital day and age, don't you think? Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
If there's one thing that we know about consumers, it's that they want what they want, and they want it now. And that goes triple for music.
In the age of social media, there's an obvious consumer frustration when a consumer knows that maybe a bigger release has been made in one country, but they can't get it in another.
Adrian Strain is a spokesman for, and I love saying this, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, which represents record labels. He says a common release day would cut down on piracy and...
We did some consumer research in 7 countries, and we found that when music fans are asked when they want music to come out, they say Friday or Saturday.
But these days, the release day rule is already losing favor. Taylor Swift released her new album, 1989, on a Monday to boost first-week sales.
The fact that the industry is still playing by the 20th century rules and worrying about release dates is an indication of where their heads are at.
Greg Kot covers music for the Chicago Tribune. He also co-hosts the radio program Sound Opinions. He says release dates are a throwback to the days when record labels would promote new albums months in advance to drive physical sales, which are less important in the iTunes era.
Increasingly, you're seeing artists, even veteran artists, David Bowie, to Beyonce, to Drake, who are relatively new artists, doing this, where they're basically just putting records out when they're done.
Kot says having a common release could make it easier to manage global marketing campaigns for some mega stars, but for most artists, the calendar just doesn't matter. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We've got a project that our weekend show has been working on with the BBC World Service that's framed roughly around this question. How do you make it in a global economy? Because whether you're running a multinational conglomerate or just your own monthly budget, there is no getting around that whole globalization thing. So for the next couple of weeks, Marketplace and BBC reporters are going to be all over the world trying to answer that question. How do you make it in a global economy? Today from Germany, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark and a waitress in Berlin.
Before we get to the waitress, a little context about the German economy in which she waits tables. Maybe when you think of the German economy, certain things come to mind. Good pay, lots of vacation, strong social safety net, and, you know, that whole cliche about...
The precision of German engineering.
The power of German engineering.
Pre-tuned by German engineers.
And for many years, those cliches were pretty right on. Precise German engineering led to lots of well-made German products, cars, engines, industrial machines, built by lots of well-paid German workers. They could be so well-paid because their well-made products were in demand around the world. It was known as the economic miracle, or to use one of those cool German compound words, the Wirtschaftswunder. And that led to another Germanism. I'll let an actual German pronounce this one.
Wohlstand für alle, which means material well-being for all.
Peter Bofinger is an economist and an advisor to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He says this concept of Wohlstand für alle, of shared prosperity, may still be the German model, but it's not always the reality these days.
In fact, we have seen in the last 20 years more or less a stagnation of living standards for the majority of the population.
And a rise in the number of working poor. As globalization leads to fewer well-paid manufacturing jobs in Germany and to more temporary, part-time, and low-paid work.
Okay, so this is our lunch menu, changing every day.
Which brings us to that waitress in Berlin.
And we have an apple wild herb salad.
Felicitas Sonnenberg. She's pulling out a notepad from a black and red polka-dotted belt strapped around her waist to take a customer's order.
So are you comfortable with chopsticks?
Yes. Felicitas makes just 8.5 euro an hour, about the equivalent of $9.70 in the U.S.
It's gastronomy, so it's difficult to find a place where you get much more.
In fact, working in gastronomy, or restaurants as we'd say in the U.S., along with taxi driving, hairdressing, and other kinds of service jobs, that's just the kind of work that many of Germany's new working poor do. Pay's gotten so low in many of these fields that at the beginning of the year, Germany established a minimum wage for the first time ever. But even with that raise, Felicitas says she still can't quite make ends meet.
It would be wonderful to live with my money, what I earn in my job, but it's not enough without help of the state.
Felicitas is divorced, raising her two kids on her own. She gets some money from the government to help pay rent, to help with daycare, and she says she's grateful for it. But in recent years, Germany, which has long been known for its strong social safety net, has been rethinking how much it spends on that net. Felicitas says she can feel that scrutiny when she goes to her local welfare office.
I recognize that they were treating me like somebody who doesn't want to work, who only wants to get the money of the state, and I am not like that.
Like, what are some of the phrases that they use?
You know, a single mother can work 8 hours a day.
Felicitas only works part-time right now, but she says as a single mom, even that can be a tough balancing act. Once Felicitas is home from work, her two kids are eager for her attention. Mommy, can I have a bath? Her daughter asks, tugging at her mom's sleeve. And once Felicitas fills that bath...
Mama, 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 mama. Everything has to be done in a certain way to finish in time to bring the children to bed at 9 o'clock.
But after they go to bed, Felicitas is busy making plans for how she's going to make it.
Yes, okay, so... One second.
She goes over to a shelf to pull out a black and red polka-dotted belt.
With buttons?
It's just like the one she wears at the restaurant to keep her pen and pad of paper for taking orders.
I developed a kind of bag. It's like a belt, a waitress belt. And I wanted to produce this and have my own company.
She's shopped her design around to people in the fashion industry, gotten coaching from state-funded agencies on how to prototype and trademark the design. She has the trademark certificate framed, hanging in a hallway in her apartment.
This is my office.
She's told the welfare agency about her efforts to start her own business. She says they warned her that might be too much for a single mother, that maybe she should stick to waitressing. And so she's torn between the income she makes now and taking a risk to make more.
I'm believing in my product because I love it and I use it every day and I think that there's really a need of this thing. But, I have a fear to go into the business market because I feel so little.
And yet, little creative startup businesses like Felicitas's are being touted by people like Chancellor Angela Merkel as one of the best new ways to make it in the German economy. And as scared as Felicitas is, she is also hopeful.
I always said, okay, when I really founded my company, I will open a bottle of champagne. But I never did it, because you never know when there is the real start.
Even with her framed trademark certificate, her prototypes, Felicitas says it's hard to know when you've really made it in the German economy these days.
I don't know when to open the bottle of champagne.
In Berlin, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
There is more from our series about the changing global economy and how to make it there. It's called Six Routes to Riches. It's on our website, marketplace.org. We've come to the end of the month, and with it, the end of our series about water. It's called The High Price of Cheap, about how we take water for granted, how we don't pay what we should for it, and how that is eventually going to bite us down the line. The poet and novelist Tiffany Yannick grew up in the U.S. Virgin Islands, surrounded by the sea, but with very little water to drink.
In the Virgin Islands, we are surrounded by water.
It's where we get our food. It's our farmland. We're big fish eaters. Our highways are the sea, the oceans that surround the different islands. You visit your cousins and grandparents by jumping on the highway of the Caribbean Sea. The water is really vital to our culture and to our understanding of ourselves. It's where we go to baptize our children. It's where we go to celebrate a wedding. It's where we go to mourn the death of a loved one. Now, I was married on the beach. I remember having first kisses on the beach in high school. Probably the entirety of my childhood memories are somewhat connected to water, connected to the beach. But water is also scarce. So Virgin Islanders store water beneath our houses like treasure. We have cisterns where we collect rainwater that we use to drink and bathe and cook our food. Water is so precious. But I do notice that since moving to New York, and even before that when I lived in Houston, you would leave your tap running. You would take long, luxurious showers. That would be considered rude to do in the Virgin Islands. If you were to visit someone's home and take a 20-minute shower, you would be bringing that person a financial burden. Virgin Islanders put a great value on water. Water is this symbol of excess because we're surrounded by it, but it's also scarcity. As a writer, I'm interested in that paradox.
Tiffany Anik is the author, among other books, of Land of Love and Drowning. This final note on the way out today. John Boehner is, as you know, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, second in line for the presidency of the United States, and he is not at all happy with the way things are going in Congress. No,
members should wear appropriate business attire during all sittings of the House, however brief their appearance on the floor may be. You know who you are.
Let's just say there's no such thing as casual Friday in Congress, huh?
Marketplace is supported by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. And by Allianz, sponsor of the Love Family Money Study. 85% of modern families identify themselves as middle class, yet 49% are living paycheck to paycheck. Learn more at AllianzUSA.com. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to reduce labor costs, improve workforce productivity, and minimize compliance risk. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
All righty, everybody, that's all we got. Today, the Dow gave back 81 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 24 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 off 6 points, 0.3%. But I'll tell you what, it was quite a February at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. I'll tell you that. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Orr. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Come on back. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.